we know that recently Russia has taken Avdiivka. With the situation right now in Ukraine, in your opinion, where is it going?
It seems that Ukraine has lost the war, but Putin continues to take his time. He's very slow. The Russians continue to advance. And I think that is a mistake, and it, for a number of reasons, I think it cost more lives by drawing it out. But it's also a mistake because today the Russian Ministry of Defense complained that NATO troops were active in Ukraine. They're responsible for the missile attacks and for coordinating the army. And there are even claims that some NATO detachments are in the advance guard of attacks on the Russian troops. So by letting this war go on, it continues to widen. You know, it's dangerous having NATO troops there. And it actually means that the war is no longer, it's not a war, that the conflict is no longer between Russia and Ukraine over the Russian areas, Donbas, that were stuck into Ukraine by Soviet governments when Russia and Ukraine were part of the same country. That's Putin's limited objective. To stop the attacks on the Russian areas that should never have been put into Ukraine. But now, if the Russian Ministry of Defense is correct, and I assume they are, Russia's not just in a conflict with Ukraine over Donbas. They're in a conflict with NATO. The NATO troops directing weapon attacks on Russians. Well, that's a widening of the war that should never have been permitted. And why did it happen? Because the Ukrainians are losing. They've lost. And the West is trying to keep the war going by sending in its own troops. Well, these types of involvements are dangerous because if it's no longer almost an internal conflict between Russia and Ukraine, but now between Russia and the West, what will the next intervention be? Clearly, the NATO troops are not going to do any better. The missiles they launch at the Russian forces continue to be, for the most part, shot down and ineffective. So what next steps does the West take? So I'm concerned that by refusing to use sufficient force to end this conflict, it goes on, and it gets wider and wider. And that's a danger. And I don't see the point of it. I don't see what's gained by drawing this out. Putin seems to think that he's won the war, and it's now all he has to do is wait for the West and Ukraine to recognize the fact. But they're not going to recognize the fact. And apparently, if they have NATO troops involved in the conflict.
Alexei Navalny has died in Russia. The media is going crazy about this case, and even Biden was talking about this. In your opinion, what's the difference between Navalny and Julian Assange? And we know that we had American journalists in Ukraine. Gonzalo Lira was killed by Ukrainians, and nobody was talking about him. How do you see this policy on the part of the Biden administration?
Well, it's a propaganda policy against Putin. So Navalny dies, and they blame Putin. They're not concerned about Navalny. They're concerned to demonize Putin. They're not concerned about Ukraine, whom they have supported with billions of dollars, killing an American journalist. They're not concerned about the journalists. The Israelis kill journalists every day, almost, certainly every week. I read the other day that they had killed the most journalists of everybody at all times. So it's not any concern about Navalny. It's just an opportunity to throw more mud at Putin. Clearly, in my opinion, see, Navalny dropped dead while he was exercising. You know, most prisons give the prisoners an hour a day out to exercise. And he was doing that and dropped dead. Now, what we know about this phenomenon of people suddenly dropping dead is they are vaxxed people, people who had the COVID-19 mRNA vaccine, as they call it. It's not a vaccine. And it causes heart attacks and strokes and sudden death. It's happening all over the world. All kinds of people are dropping dead, including sport athletes in their prime, in the middle of a game, performers in the middle of a performance, and so on. Pilots have actually died in flight. You know, they force the airline pilots to be vaccinated, or they fire them, or they resigned. And so all the pilots flying were vaccinated. And apparently, the vaccine kills a certain number of people and injures and maims a certain number of people. We don't really know why some fall dead and others don't. Maybe they all will eventually. I mean, so I think that Navalny was probably vaccinated, and he died as a consequence. It's very difficult to murder somebody while he's out exercising. I mean, I assume all the prisoners are out, and guards, and it's not, if you were going to murder him, they'd murder him in his cell, the way we murdered Epstein. So you don't murder them out in plain view of the prison population. So, and what would be the point of murdering him? I mean, now you ask about the difference between Navalny and Julian Assange. Well, Navalny got a trial. He was tried. Julian Assange has never been tried. He's been in prison for 10 years. He's never had charges brought against him, and he's not been convicted, but he's already served 10 years. So Navalny was tried. He was given a light sentence. He was then given probation. He was out on probation. He violated the terms of the probation and got a more severe sentence. So that's why he was back in the prison. He had actually been released. All he had to do was obey the terms he agreed to when they released him on probation. He decided not to, or most likely was paid by the United States not to, in order to make more of a case against Putin. So he's put back in prison, and then the jab caught up with him. I'm convinced it was the jab. There's no, you know, this phenomenon of people just dropping dead suddenly. People who you would think in the prime of their life, athletes. You know, when you see strong young men dropping dead in a soccer game, we've never seen anything like that before, ever. And it's becoming a happening. So that's, I think, what that is. And yet there's more uproar over Navalny than Julian Assange, who's not had a trial and who is kept in a maximum security prison. I don't think he even gets his hour a day of exercise. And so that's where the outrage should be, that in Britain, operating according to Washington's orders, they've managed to keep a person in one form of imprisonment or the other for a decade. And the pretense is they're trying to decide whether or not to hand him over to Washington. And so it's taken them 10 years, it's taken them forever. But it's a very convenient way to keep him locked up without a trial, without a conviction. And I think it's very demoralizing to his supporters. And it probably scares donors to WikiLeaks, because if they can do this to somebody, what can they can do the same to the donors. They can claim, well, the donors, if they hadn't given the money to WikiLeaks, Julian Assange couldn't have done whatever it is they think he might have done. So I think they find it more effective than a trial, because they don't really have any charges. He's not an American citizen, so he can't be accused of treason or spying. I mean, so it just strikes me as another indication of the total lack of integrity of the entirety of the West, all of the governments, all of the media. There's just no integrity. And we can have no confidence whatsoever in any Western institution.
How did you find the latest interview of Putin with Tucker Carlson? We know that the mainstream media was attacking Carlson for doing this interview. And what was in this interview that wasn't good for the mainstream media, for the elites in the West?
Well, Putin explained that the war hadn't started in 2022 when the Russians moved into Donbass, the Russian area. He explained that it started in 2014, if not before. Actually, I think it started before. And Putin may have made that point, because he did refer to the money that the United States had been funneling for years into Ukraine to create this opposition force, to create the NGOs, to radicalize some of the students, and to support the Banderas, the followers of the Ukrainians who had fought against the Soviet Union in World War II. Who had fought for the German army. And he pointed out that she had actually bragged on television of having spent $5 billion in Ukraine preparing for the Maidan Revolution. So the war was started by the Americans. They spent years building up the internal conditions for the Maidan Revolution in 2014. And it was 8 years later, after Putin could no longer hope for the Minsk agreement to be enforced, that he finally had to go in, because he made the mistake of waiting 8 years while the United States built a very large Ukrainian army. And that army was poised to overrun Donbass and reincorporate the Russian areas into the Ukraine, which would mean slaughtering a lot of the people, because the Donbas had declared its independence and had separated in two republics. There were two groups, and they so he simply couldn't stand there and 8 more years and watch these Russians be slaughtered. Yeah, I think it would have ruined him politically in Russia, and certainly convinced the West that he was a pushover and incapable of resisting any kind of aggression. So he really had no choice. Basically, Putin was forced to intervene by the aggressiveness of the United States. So I think that was very important. He made the case very clearly and very dispassionately. And he refused opportunities to demonize the American leaders. And he came across, I thought, as far too reasonable and far too patient. And I think that's the wrong signal for him to be sending to a bunch like in Washington. The neoconservatives see this and they think, well, he's a pushover. And so I think that's irrespective of any funding for the war. I think this is mainly a political issue for the Democrats and the Republicans. It is a situation where the Republicans say, well, we're not going to vote for it unless you close the border. And the Democrats are not going to close the border. They would rather have the United States overrun by 3.6 million people every year than to fight in Ukraine. So I think the financing is being lost to the Democrats' preference to have a wide open border. And it's come to light that the United States government itself finances the organization of these immigrant invaders. They're recruited from all over the world, financed, brought in, given maps of the pathways along which there's accommodation, food, water, health care. Some of them are actually guarded along the way so that they can't be have the women and the children captured by sex traffickers, by the human trafficking gangs in Mexico, because they want them to show up at the border. And this is all organized and it's paid for by the United States government, the Biden administration, for example. So clearly, if the Democrats valued more aid to Ukraine as much as they value allowing in unlimited numbers of illegals, they would make the deal. Okay, we'll close the border and you approve the money and we'll give it to Ukraine. But they don't agree. So that tells you the Democrats are more interested in having the United States invaded by millions of people from all over the world. These are no longer Mexicans. I mean, a few may be. They're not even mainly Hispanics, as far as I can tell. They're even Chinese there. They're Arabs, Indians, Israelis. Why? So clearly, the Democrats are more interested in creating within the United States a Tower of Babel, a disunited, diverse country that has no unity. I guess they assume a country that is so disunified is easier to rule because it can't unite against the government. So that's really what the Democrats' main goal is, and they will sacrifice Ukraine to that goal and are sacrificing it.
One of the questions that Tucker Carlson asked Putin was why the United States decided to go to war with Russia in Ukraine in the first place. Putin said that in the eyes of the elites of the United States, the biggest enemy is China, is not Russia. If that's the case, in your opinion, why they started this war with Russia in Ukraine?
Well, I think Putin is wrong. Russia is the big enemy because it's the most convenient. The Americans are long accustomed to the Russians being the enemy. It's the Cold War, it goes back to the Soviet Union. And so it's easy for the Americans to think of Russians as the enemy because they've been the enemy since Churchill gave his Iron Curtain speech. And what was that, 1946, 47, 48, something like that. And the whole struggle of the 20th century, the struggle that all the current leaders in Washington grew up in, was the Cold War with the Soviet Union. So the Russians are easy to present as enemies. And the reason we started the war in Ukraine was to underline the danger of Russia. So Russia invaded. They didn't invade. They came in to clear Donbass of Ukrainian troops. They didn't invade Ukraine. This has been one of my criticisms of Putin, that he didn't understand that he needed to invade, get the thing over with in a couple of weeks, and not let it just go on and on and on because the risk of it spinning out of control are ever present. So, and that might be over with now because it looks like they can't get the funding to continue it. Now, maybe the United States will make the EU do the funding because they're puppet states. So if Biden can't get the money, what they'll probably do is force Germany and France and England and Italy and so forth to fund it. And then they'll find some way to funnel some other kind of money from some other budget to them to compensate them for the funding. So that could well happen. In other words, the funding can be disapproved and yet still happen. But China, what has China done? They haven't invaded anybody that we can make an enemy out of them. They haven't invaded Taiwan. They speak tough sometimes, but they don't do anything. And the rest of the countries in Asia see them as good investors, friends. They say, we're not going to bomb you into democracy. We're going to make you rich. Here's the deal. How do we make China look evil? Well, we try to blame our trade deficit with China on them. But it's obvious that the trade deficit is due to the American corporations who offshored all their production to China. And when this production is brought back to America to be sold, it blows up the trade deficit. It comes in as imports. And that's where the trade deficit comes from. It's the offshore production of Apple, Nike, Levi, all the big American firms who manufacture with Chinese labor in China the goods they sell to Americans. So it's not China that's the villain. You can say it's the American corporations. And so they try to blame China for what the American corporations did to the American workforce, leaving them out of job with low-paid shelf-stocking jobs at big box stores. And they try to blame this on China. So it doesn't really work. I think this was a disservice that Donald Trump did because he started going on and on about China and China. But I think he had to show he was tough in defending America because of Russiagate, when he had been pictured as a Russian agent and spy and selling out the country. You remember the CIA director accused him of treason. All of this absurd stuff. made Trump feel like he's got to show somewhere he's tough, standing up for America. And so he made an issue of China, but China's not done anything. It may be the case that some of the American foreign policy people are realizing that China's economy is leaving us far behind. It's just growing rapidly. It's unlike ours. It's well developed. It's a powerful manufacturer, industrialist. I mean, we don't, our manufacturing industry shrinks every day. And so people may be looking at this and saying, you know, what can we do? We can't compete with them. All of our companies are operating over there. I don't know why Putin said that what he did about the Americans viewing China as enemies is absolutely not the case. There are no forces that they can confront China with. It's not surrounded by NATO countries. It's hard to. They can send carrier fleets, but these fleets can be blown out of the water at any minute in the Chinese missiles. You know, the aircraft carriers now are outmoded. They're like muskets in the day of machine guns. They're sitting ducks, they're targets. They can't be defended. And so trying to create a scenario of Chinese aggression is not easy. But you see, now that it looks like the Ukraine war may wear out, regardless of Putin letting it go on, it may still be wearing out. We see all of the European leaders now talking about, oh, we've got to get ready for a war with Russia. And we have the NATO Secretary General, what is the fool's name? The Stoltenberg, saying we'll be at war with Russia in a few years and we're not prepared. And you see all the British foreign minister talking about we got to get prepared for war with Russia and France saying this and Germany saying, well, why? It's to keep alive the image that Russia's the enemy. You see? So I don't know why Putin said what he said. It makes no sense. And I hope he doesn't really believe that. Maybe it was some political reason, or maybe he just didn't want to sound threatening, or I don't know. I have no idea.
German finance minister recently said that Germany is having so much difficulties in maintaining defense spending at 2% of their GDP. At the same time, we saw that they have been signing an agreement, a military pact with Japan to contain China. And recently, Olaf Scholz signed an agreement on security guarantees for Ukraine. Why they're doing this to Germany? Because they're making Germany a potential enemy of Russia and China at the same time. And who's ruling Germany?
Europe are they're American satellites. They are puppets. They have been since 1945. The last independent country in Europe was France under de Gaulle in the 1960s. That was it. And when de Gaulle was out, France ceased to be an independent country. Germany is still occupied. What is how many years after World War II? You know, 70 years, or let's see, 55 plus 25, 80 years. They're still occupied. And so these countries are not independent, and they do what they're instructed to do. Why do they do that? Oh, it's a good question. Maybe they feel it's too late and they can't get loose. There's nothing they can do. I don't know. I haven't, or maybe they just paid off. You know, I've said before in interviews that my PhD dissertation chairman was the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs. And I once asked, I said, how do we get all these European countries to always do what we want? And he said, money. And I said, Joe, you mean foreign aid? He said, no. He said, we give the leaders bagfuls of money. We own them. They report to us. He didn't approve of it. There was nothing he could do about it. And so that may be the answer. It's just like the German editor of that large newspaper in Germany, Udo Ulfalki was his name. He died a few years ago. He wrote this book, Bought Journalism, in which he said that every significant journalist in Europe was on the CIA's payroll. He said, myself included. He says, they would bring me the stories that I should print. So they don't have an independent press, neither does the United States. But the European press is not independent and the governments are not independent. So to ask why they do something, you'd ask Washington, why did you tell them to do that? And so, but you know, the whole notion of Japan and Germany containing China is laughable. That's Germany. How's Germany going to get anywhere close to China? And Japan is a small island. We totally demilitarized it. And the defeat they suffered in World War II was so humiliating. I don't think they have any martial spirit left. The Japanese could not possibly field an army today like they had in World War II. Those people were highly motivated and there's no such thing today. Plus, the population is aging and aging. And they wouldn't have much of an army to field, and it has no motivation. And so I just don't understand. It's just, I think, Nima, to cut to the chase, all this is talk to keep profits going to the American armaments industries. And that's what it's about. It's our only remaining industry. And so we need wars in preparation for wars, which means we need enemies. And it's a lot easier to have all the Europeans buying weapons from us to fight against Russia than it is to get them to buy weapons to fight against China, because you know we're close to China's borders. How are they gonna how are they gonna fight China? I mean, there's no real prospect of them fighting China. How are they gonna get there? And so I think that's what it is. War talk, preparation for war, war. This serves the armaments makers in the United States, and they are an extremely powerful lobby group.
One of the issues that Putin raised during this interview, he said in his interaction with the US presidents, doesn't matter if you have a Republican or Democrat, there is a court behind the scene who are deciding about everything. Do you think he's right? Who are these people?
Of course, he's right. And the reason Clinton and Bush came back and said, no, we can't do this, is that these people who actually rule told him, say, you can't take away the enemy. We have to have an enemy. It's our power, it's our budget, our profits. You don't take away our enemy. So that's the reason that the interests of Clinton and Bush very quickly was killed. Now, who are these people? Well, It's very interesting, Nima. Just the other day, I think the 16th of February, Tucker Carlson interviewed Mike Binns, who is the world's leading expert on the censorship industry. And in this interview, which is about an hour and 5 minutes, Mike Binns tells the whole world who our rulers are. And they are the consensus building institutions who have redefined democracy from the will of the people to the protection of the sanctity of democratic institutions. What are these institutions? It's not Congress voting, it's not a rule of law and an independent judiciary. It's the interest of the military security complex, the big financial organizations, the World Bank, the IMF, NATO, the NGOs. There's an endless number of NGOs, and he names them. And I wrote about it, I think yesterday or this morning. It's on my website, paulcraigroberts.org. I wrote about the interview. I posted the link to the interview and pointed out who these groups are. For example, the Atlantic Council, the Aspen Institute. It's a combination of the elite organizations and groups and the large corporations and the intelligence and military sectors. They are the ones who get together and come to agreement on which agendas get priority or where your agenda ranks in the overall. And they're the ones who set the narratives in the media that the media repeats and repeats and repeats. And they're the ones who control the explanations. And their conclusion is that they cannot allow any criticism. And so Mike Binns points out all of the organizations they have created that are set up to close down all information that's not official narrative. And he points out they're already after Elon Musk because they had Twitter, but when Elon Musk bought it and renamed it X, he opened up the freedom. So now the Justice Department has seven investigations of Musk underway. It looks like they intend to force him out as CEO so they can put Twitter back into their basket of compliant organizations that help them monitor people who have to be shut down. So it explains everything. And you really should try to interview Mike Binns, or at least listen to the interview several times and report on it yourself, like I did this morning or yesterday. I think it must have been that maybe it was this morning. And you'll see. And then what you'll also see is that the United States government is a contributor to these organizations like the Atlantic Council or the Aspen group and so on and so on. They're endless. The university is a part of it. Stanford University in California is a big part of this. And they develop AI programs that can monitor everything that's said on the internet, identify from words used those that have to be yanked, pulled, shut down. People who have to be deplatformed. It's an endless, and a lot of tech companies are in it. The tech companies, they cooperate with the government in this. So we have a group of elites, and some of them are part of the government, some of them aren't, who work together to determine political outcomes. And the political outcomes are totally unrelated to anything Congress does or the president does, or what, because these groups pull the strings and they set the agendas and they control the explanations. And now they are protecting these agendas and narratives by shutting down everyone who takes exception. So what it, and now they have defined truth as an attack on democracy. If you tell the truth, you're attacking democracy. And Mike Vince shows how this works, how they do it. And there are now a huge number of government agencies that did not exist when I was in the government, whose entire function is to track people who have to be shut up. And they shut you up by pulling your stuff and by deplatforming you and causing you endless problems. And now apparently they're going to bring some kind of legal charges against Musk and hope to create a situation that that his own boards force him out of the executive position. So that's the answer. Basically, these groups, these elite groups, have terminated democracy throughout the West. It's not just the U.S. It's throughout the West. I think I said that this is the last year of free speech and democracy in the Western world. This year is the last. And I think that's true. I think they've shown enough determination. They've shown they're completely willing to weaponize law, to have Stalin-like, Kafkaesque-type trials, to make up any kind of lie and defend it to the death, to discredit all truth as some kind of disinformation or terrorist act. So it's not a very hopeful outlook for Western peoples.
The Netanyahu administration was pushing these people, Gazans, from the northern part to the southern part of Gaza. Right now, they're trying to drag them to the northern part. What's the policy right now there? Why they're doing this?
The policy is to destroy Palestine. It's been their policy since 1947. And no one has ever stopped them. Sometimes opposition causes them to back off and wait a while, but they always restart it. So it's been going on, you know, for 70, 80 years. They've been destroying these people systematically. And when the when Palestine was petitioned by the UN between Israel and Palestine, Palestine still was a contentious part. It was all connected. And that is still the boundaries of Palestine. The boundaries have never been changed. It's just that Israel ceased to observe them and moved in and started eating away year by year, tearing down Palestinian villages, plowing up their olive groves, building apartments for settlers. And so what we have is an illegal occupation. See, most of what now comprises Israel is Palestine, because the original division of the territory between the two has not been changed legally. It's been changed by the relentless policy of Israel in taking another village. So if they had gone in 1947, 48, and just took it all right then, they would have been stopped. There would have been a big uproar. But you see, they didn't do that. They said, let me take this tiny little piece right here. And then next year, we'll take this piece. And so they did it. It's death by a thousand cuts. They killed Palestine by a thousand cuts. And each cut didn't look to the rest of the world, or the Arabs even, as enough to go to war over, or to really get aggressive with Israel about. And Israel, of course, always was portrayed as the victim, never the Palestinians whose villages they were stealing. To try to say, well, why was they pushed them this way and then pushed them this, what does it matter? What they're going to do, they're doing is exterminating. They're being exterminated. Including the few remaining parts of the West Bank, most of which aren't even connected to one another. And nobody's doing anything about it. So they got away with the death by a thousand cuts for so long that now they can end the whole thing. And that's what they're doing. Once again, we see the Arabs, who could have made it very uncomfortable for Israel, because when they first went in to Gaza, they were having trouble with Hamas. Well, that was a perfect time for Hezbollah to attack. It's a perfect time for Syria and Iraq to attack. Perfect time for Iran to release the missiles. Israel would have been defeated. Instead, everybody didn't do anything. So now it looks like Israel are, succeeding against the Gazans, are getting prepared to invade Lebanon and take on Hamas. Well, you see, they're getting them one at a time. The hesitancy. See, the Arabs always make this stupid mistake. Instead of acting as a unit, they're knocked off one at a time. And they can't see it. So, what looks like is happening is Israel is moving the settlers from the northern part of Israel, that is the border with Lebanon, where the Hezbollah militia is. They're moving them out of the way, and it looks like it's after they finish off the Palestinians, they're going after Hezbollah. Well, what will the Arabs do? They'll sit there just like they always do, and Hezbollah being gone. Then they'll pick somebody else and they'll go after them, and they'll sit there like they always do. So it looks to me like that's what's going to unfold. People simply they can't see what's happening, or they are unwilling to do anything about it, even though they know they're next. And the same holds for Iran. They're the target far more than Hamas or the Gazans or the Palestinians. Iran's the target. The Israelis have been trying to get us to attack Iran for 20 years or longer. What would stop all this and prevent all this would be a joint announcement by Russia, Iran, and China of a mutual defense treaty. Attack on once, attack on all. Then nobody's going to attack Iran.
When you look at the interaction between the Biden administration and the Netanyahu administration, we know that without this help going from the United States to Israel, Israel is not capable of continuing this conflict, this war in Gaza. If that's the case, who's leading in Israel?
Well, Netanyahu's leading. This is a Netanyahu operation, and the American foreign policy officials are all Jews. They're the neoconservatives, almost, or the influential ones. They're Jewish. Many of them are joint American-Israeli citizens. They're Zionists. So when the State Department, the Secretary of State's a Jew, and he says, I'm an Israeli. And Victoria Nuland, who's the undersecretary or the deputy secretary, she's Jewish. She's a neoconservative. The whole group of them. And so I'm sure it's a very close cooperation between Washington and Israel. Look, before the war even started, we had aircraft carrier battle groups there. We had airborne troops that we had Air Force personnel there. Well, you had to know it was coming in order to have them ready to be there. It takes time to mobilize things. They clearly were already mobilized and probably already on the way. Obviously, there's a high degree of collaboration. And clearly, Washington wants the Israelis to achieve their goals because they don't do anything to stop the genocide. That's what it is, it's a genocide. As you said, it's the American supply of bombs and missiles that's enabling it. I doubt Israel has the capability of making the rockets and bombs in the numbers that have been used. I've heard things like they've already used explosives in 3 months, larger in power than the entirety of those used in World War II. Now, I don't know if these things are true or not. I have no idea, but they're said by people who normally are knowledgeable and serious. So, clearly, it's something that the people who control won't happen. And I think the reason that we quickly had so many forces there, because it seems unlikely to me that our aircraft carriers would be needed against Hamas or our airborne troops. We're going to drop American paratroopers into Gaza. I mean, or that the Israeli Air Force would need our F-15s and our pilots. They were there for Iran. They were hoping that this would quickly become a wide war and we would finally have an excuse to attack Iran. And as Iran and China and Russia have done nothing whatsoever to prevent this, all they have to do is have a press conference and say, we've just signed a mutual defense treaty. That's the end of this threat. And apparently, they either don't realize the threat or don't think it's very likely, or I have no idea. I don't know what the cost to them of acknowledging such a treaty, because it certainly makes it difficult for the West to continue aggressiveness toward them, because there's no prospect of the West facing that kind of a military force. It's too large, it's too powerful. And so, as I've always said, a lot of this trouble comes just from the reluctance of our chosen enemies to be decisive.
There were two key words in this interview of Vladimir Putin with Tucker Carlson. When he was describing relationship with China, he said that the foreign policy of China is not about aggression, it's all about compromise and cooperation. We know that he has some hopes of having this kind of compromise and cooperation with the United States. We've seen the same idea, the same concept for Xi in his last visit to the United States.
I think that the Xi and Putin are daydreaming. They're delusional. The United States is not interested in any compromise. They made it clear over and over and over and over. And I don't understand how She and Putin can still re refuse to see what's so obvious. We intend to destroy them, not compromise with them. I mean, look, everything, did we compromise about the Minsk agreement? No, we deceived them. When they tried to have the security agreement before they went into Donbass, what did we do? Gave them the cold shoulder, brushed them off, told them to go fly their tight kite. Whatever China tries to do, we just tell them to go to hell. It's Iran, oh gosh, the evil, totally evil terrorist. There's no effort. How can you compromise somebody that you say is Hitler? When whatever happens in the world, the first thing you do, you blame Putin. Whatever happens, Putin did it. He blew up his own pipeline. He shot down the Malaysian airliner, right? He killed Navalny. He killed the other guy in England, the Skripals. Whatever happens, you talk about people like this over and over and over for decades, and they still think they can compromise with you. Something's wrong with them. That's what I think is. Putin is unrealistic, or else he's pretending for some other reason and doesn't want the conflict yet, or whatever. Maybe they aren't ready for the conflict. They want to be have the conflict when there's no possibility whatsoever of the United States landing even one missile on it. Maybe that's, I don't know. It could be something like that, but and in other words, they're just being clever. It's an act, creates the impression that they're not dangerous and they're delusional, and I don't know that they really are. Maybe they decide that this is the best way to handle this for now. I just don't know. But I think that it's for certain there's, unless there's a sudden collapse of the dollar, massive chaos inside the United States, something that makes it clear that we can't function, then we might be interested in a compromise. But until something happens that shows the United States is dysfunctional and really can't perform, I don't think there's any interest in Washington in a compromise. And you have to remember too, a compromise ends conflict, and then so what becomes of the military security complex's power and budget, and what becomes of the unipolar world that the elites are committed to. We want to be the ones who exploit the world. And so the interest groups that rule us don't have an interest in ending the conflict. The conflict benefits them. And the appearance of enemies gives us excuses to overthrow governments, assassinate people, and do all kinds, and also impose tyranny on our own people. We tell them we have to do this to keep you safe from our enemies. So they claim that shutting up Americans is a way of protecting us, because we have to shut up Americans, or the enemies will speak through some Americans. And it's not any interest in the ruling elites in compromise. They want to dominate, and they won't easily give up their belief in this. And the fact they don't meet any real firm resistance from Russia or China or even Iran makes them confident that they can eventually prevail. And all the trouble in Ukraine has caused endless trouble for Ukraine, and but none for the United States. Caused some for Europe because of all the refugees. I think it initially caused a lot of discomfort for Putin. I don't know now. I think now the people in Russia are content. But I certainly don't see any sign of compromise. If the Democrats won't even compromise with Republicans, their own citizens, why are they going to compromise with Putin or Xi or the mullahs in Iran? Why? I mean, if the Democrats are trying to frame up a president of the United States on false charges and preventing him from running for election, why are they going to compromise with Putin? It's stupid to think that. I mean, and I think that there's so much unrealism, there are no real constraints on Washington. Without realism, where are the constraints?